Last Transport, Part 2. Department of Expatriate Affairs, Government Center, Kandor, New Krypton, Cygnus Sector. The director of the Department of Expatriate Affairs, that branch of the Neo-Kryptonian government charged with monitoring the activities of members of the Kryptonian race who chose to leave that race's adopted homeworld, was a man named Zod. A former general in the New Krypton Defense Force, he of course had another name, but almost no one knew what it was. To even his closest intimates, if such a man could be said to have any, he was simply Zod. Today, Zod sat in his office near the top of the Government Center spire and considered his options. The act gave him pleasure, because he knew that his options were, for the first time in a long time, wide open. Very soon now he would be able to abandon this ridiculous sinecure pressed upon him by the ineffectual fools of the Science Council and take the place he had always felt was truly his by right. The intercom panel on his desk breathed. "General Zod," came the voice of his chief aide.
"Yes, Ursa," Zod replied.
"We've just received word from the Department of State about a citizenship application being processed in the Republic of Zeta Cygni," Ursa reported.
Zod raised an eyebrow. "There have been no emigrations to Zeta Cygni in 2 years."
"I know, sir. The situation is somewhat unusual. I have prepared a briefing file."
"By all means, pipe it over."
"At once, General." The intercom clicked off. A moment later, a file appeared on Zod's desktop data term. As he read it, the general's craggy face slowly settled into a glacially impenetrable mask, utterly expressionless. Only the bunching of muscles at the corners of his wide, thin-lipped mouth betrayed the fury that was mounting behind that mask. 2 minutes later, he punched the intercom online and said in a voice like granite,
"Ursa, ready an alpha team."
There was no reply. A moment later, the door to Zod's office opened and Ursa entered, her regularly featured but cruel face wearing a look of puzzlement. Once the door was shut behind her, she punched a combination into the keypad next to it that engaged the room's privacy mode, preventing any outside surveillance from picking up what was said within.
"An alpha team?" she asked him, incredulous. "For this?"
Zod swiveled, rose from his chair, and stepped toward her.
"Are you questioning my orders, Ursa?" he asked.
"Not in defiance, sir," she said quickly. "I just... why?" Zod's thin lips quirked in a parody of a smile.
"Try to put yourself in my position, Ursa. After decades of patience and careful maneuvering, you have finally rid New Krypton of the dead weight of its pre-settlement past. Not 2 months ago, you finally saw the last of that infuriating relic Jor-El and his wretched family. And then, on the eve of your ultimate triumph, his brother's daughter turns up alive and well in the care of that miserable Earthman."
Looming over his assistant, the general looked down at her and asked cordially,
"Do you not think, Ursa, that you might find this turn of events vexing?"
To her credit, Ursa didn't wilt under her leader's obvious bad mood. In a reasonable tone, she said,
"She's a child."
"She's a threat," Zod replied flatly. "Any living member of the House of El is a threat, and I will not tolerate threats."
Striding away from her, he stood looking out the window at the brilliant red sunshine bathing the streets of Kandor.
"No more delays, Ursa. Our time is now. Ready the Alpha Team."
Ursa hesitated for an instant longer, then came to attention.
"As you command, General," she said, then turned to leave.
"And, Ursa," Zod said, still looking out the window.
She paused.
"Yes?"
Zod turned and fixed her with a steady gaze.
"Release Non."
Ursa did her best not to look unnerved. She failed, but not by much, and her voice didn't falter as she replied, "Yes, General." International Police Headquarters, New Avalon. In New Avalon, another powerful man stood in an office on a high floor of an important building, but his mind was on rather less weighty matters than Zod's. In fact, at the very moment General Zod was ordering his aide to ready an Alpha team, Griffin was scoring the 1,000,000th point in his workday's end game of space paranoids. "I hate to interrupt your vigorous defense of the system, Chief," came the impish voice of Luornu Durgo from the doorway, "but you have a visitor." Griffin entered his initials, then turned to see Kara entering the room. "Hey," he said, grinning. "I was just going to call and see what you wanted me to bring home for dinner." Kara shrugged. "I got tired of hiding in the house," she said. "Figured I'd come down and see what's so great about this city of yours." "And?" he asked, raising an eyebrow. "Pretty impressive," she said with a smile. "Did you check it out from the air?" he asked. Kara shook her head. "Took the subway," she said. "A lot of traffic up there. I wasn't sure how I'd do." Griffin grinned again. "Well, tell you what. Why don't you head up to the roof and wait there for a second, and we'll find out." He arrived 5 minutes later to find her leaning against the railing around the rooftop helipad, facing into the slightly chilly afternoon breeze. The cold didn't bother her, of course. She turned at the sound of the metal roofway door banging open to see that Griffin had prepared for it. He was dressed in heavy canvas trousers and sturdy-looking boots, and was zipping up a bulky sheepskin bomber jacket as he emerged. Under his arm, he had a slightly battered half-bowl helmet with a rakish fin on top. Strapped to his back was a double-barreled silvery contraption Kara recognized as a rather old-fashioned atmospheric thruster pack, one with manual control units built into gloves. "Ready?" he asked. "Are you sure this is a good idea?" she asked as he snugged the helmet onto his head and dropped a pair of tinted goggles over his eyes. "No," he said, grinning again, and then he thumbed the igniters and rocketed away, leaving a pair of scorch marks on the concrete of the roof. Without really thinking about it, Kara followed. Griffin couldn't look back without pulling a U-turn, thanks to the rudder on his helmet, but he knew she was right behind him. Catching up would be child's play for her. The X-3 jetpack he was wearing could only do about 250 miles an hour, flat out. Without an atmosphere system and real flight gear, that was quite fast enough to suit him. Speed wasn't really the point of the exercise anyway. Maneuverability was. He looked up, shifted his weight, and kicked in the pack's afterburners, hurling himself skyward. When they were clear of the city's traffic patterns, he rolled out of the turn, stealing a glance aft as he pulled through the maneuver. Sure enough, Kara was right with him, and the look of absolute glee on her face was something to behold. Griffin wondered with a trace of wistfulness what it must feel like to fly like that. He was an expert rocketeer and had a lot of time in supersonic flight armor as well as antique rigs like this one. But what must it be like to just fly, with nothing more than the thought of flying to propel you? He'd probably never know, but this was fun enough. He made a game out of it, cutting his throttle so that she would dart out in front of him, then boosting and diving when she circled back. They went booming out over Lake Daniels in echelon formation, and as Kara's confidence increased, she matched him vector for vector through increasingly complex maneuvers. To make this a real test, he'd have to get a flight armor with an inertia vector control system, but that was for later. This one was just for fun. They swept low over the lake, almost brushing the tops of the light chop in the harbor, and paced a cargo hydrofoil inbound from Kaiser Island, waving to the crew. Then Griffin turned back toward the city and redlined again, his contrail drawing a wide white arc around the Wadehead lighthouse, before he cut the thrusters altogether and dropped lightly to the sidewalk on the Embarcadero. Kara landed next to him like she'd been doing it all her life, her face aglow with satisfaction. "That was incredible," she said. "I mean, I knew my people could do that kind of thing under the right conditions, but wow." Griffin pulled off his helmet, raked his fingers through his hair, and laughed. I haven't done that in too long myself. I'd almost forgotten how much fun it is. He angled a thumb at a nearby restaurant. Dinner? Just a snack, she said. I'm going to Titan's Tower for taco night. Griffin chuckled. Your social calendar's already filling up, he said as they walked down the street to the restaurant. Which reminds me, I got a call this afternoon from a guy named Sage. Did he mention he'd talk to me? Griffin asked. Kara nodded. He sounded kind of weird. Griffin laughed. He is kind of weird, but under the circumstances, I think he's the best guy for the job. Well, if you say so. Inside, they were shown to seats and ordered appetizers, and then Griffin said, You don't have to talk to him if you don't want. I just thought you might like to get it out of the way and fix one of the most trustworthy reporters in town, even if he is wound a little too tight. Kara nodded. No, I'll talk to him. I just wanted to make sure he was on the level. She looked faintly uncomfortable and added, It never really occurred to me that my being here might be news. Well, it's a big deal. A new survivor of an old tragedy. It's a human interest story. The buzz will settle down after a while, unless you keep yourself in the headlines, Griffin said with a little grin. What, you mean do the costume thing? She said with a grin. Tempting. Assuming you stay here, or someplace similar, Griffin added, you don't have to. I'm sure the Neo-Kryptonian government would make some arrangement if you wanted to go home. Home is a planet that blew up 400 years ago, Kara replied. I'm sure New Krypton is nice, and I want to check it out sometime, but go and live there? With Cousin Cal missing, and Uncle Jor and Aunt Lara gone? She trailed off, stirring her iced tea with her straw and looking pensive. Then looked up and met his eyes. You're as close to family as I've got, she said, her voice hushed. Griffin smiled and put a hand over hers. I'm not trying to get rid of you, Kara, he said. Are you sure? She asked, her eyes glistening a little. I know this must be weird for you. I mean, I feel like I said goodbye to you on Krypton earlier this week. I keep reminding myself that it's been 400 years for you. Everything's so different now. I wouldn't blame you if you wanted me to go somewhere else. He shook his head, patting her hand. Don't even think about it again, he said. I can't tell you how it made me feel to find out that you were alive after all this time, or how honored I was when I realized that your father sent you to me, that he felt I was your best chance. No, I'd never tell you to leave. You're welcome to stay with me as long as you want. I just wanted to be sure you knew you didn't have to. Kara smiled again, a slightly smaller version of the dazzler she'd worn when coming out of the sky, and made a clumsy attempt at leaning across the booth to hug him. Then I guess you're stuck with me, she said. Kara spent a happy weekend hanging out with the Titans, shopping for clothes that suited her style a bit better, and filling out paperwork. Her Kryptonian education, supplemented by everything she'd picked up as the daughter of one of Krypton's greatest scientists, had already taken her well beyond the curriculum offered in the Avalon County public school system, so finding a place to enroll wasn't a concern. Getting the appropriate equivalencies filed was, though, and then there was the question of citizenship to consider. Krypton no longer existed, and Kara had gone missing before the Neo-Kryptonian government had been formed. In the end, that was solved through the simple expedient of an adoption certificate, which tied off a number of the legal loose ends and provided for automatic Zaytan citizenship at the same time. Monday, April 26th, 2410, New Avalon, Zeta Cygni. On Monday, Zod arrived. The Neo-Kryptonian general and Griffin didn't like each other. On three past occasions, Zod had come to New Avalon in his official capacity, that of tracking, subduing, and repatriating rogue Neo-Kryptonian expatriates. On none of those occasions had Griffin shown what Zod would consider proper consideration by local authorities to his mission. On the last, the man had actually had the gall to have several of his own super-agents block Zod's people from carrying out their mission until the IPO could handle the situation themselves. This was not a way to get on Zod's good side, if indeed he could be said to have one. As such, he was cordial but frosty as he entered Griffin's office, presented his credentials, and said he wished to speak with Kara Zor-El. "Why?" Griffin asked. "She's done nothing wrong." Zod inclined his head. "I know," he said. "I didn't intend to suggest that she had. Pursuing fugitives isn't all of my job, though, as you are well aware. Part of my office's function is to ensure the safety and stability of all those of Kryptonian blood who choose to live away from New Krypton." Griffin considered this, then nodded graciously. "All right," he said. "I'll ask her if she wants to talk to you." "I appreciate your coming all this way, General, but I'm fine," Kara said. "I'm settling in nicely here. I have everything I need." Zod steepled his fingers. "And you've no interest in coming back to New Krypton? It's your homeworld now," he said. Kara shook her head. "Krypton was my homeworld. I do plan to visit New Krypton someday, but not right away." "Why do you want to stay here, Kara Zor-El?" Zod asked. Kara blinked as though the question puzzled her. "I just told you. Griffin's the closest thing I have to family now. I have friends here. I don't have anything on New Krypton." "Your people don't count as anything?" Zod asked mildly. Before Kara could formulate a response to that question, he went on. "Are you certain it isn't something else about New Avalon that appeals to you? Do you want to stay here because you're reluctant to give up the power that its yellow sun gives you? Has it occurred to you what you could do with that power in a place like this?" Kara's brow furrowed. "What are you implying?" "I imply nothing. I'm asking," Zod said. "Asking you to be honest with me, and yourself. The power of a yellow sun is seductive, I know. I feel it right now. Every time I come to a world like this in search of a countryman, it's something of a letdown to go home. For some, the power becomes addictive, and so does its exercise. When that happens, I have to involve myself." Leaning forward, Zod went on, "Let me be frank with you. I don't like to involve myself here. The local authorities are uncooperative, and the city itself teems with well-meaning interlopers who have to be dealt with. Conducting operations here is annoying, and I would rather not have to come back here to apprehend you in 6 months or a year. So I'm asking, is the power the reason you want to stay? And if not, what would drive you to remain in an alien world, a place where you don't belong, surrounded by beings who are vastly your inferiors?" Kara stood up. "I've had enough of this," she said. "I wouldn't have come if I had known you were just going to insult me and my friends." "Sit down," Zod said, his voice calm but commanding. "I haven't completed the interview."
"I've answered all the questions I'm going to answer from you," Kara snapped. "I'm a Zaytan citizen. I'm not under your jurisdiction. My coming here was my father's dying wish, and I am not leaving. And if you have some kind of problem with that, then you can go to hell."
So saying, she left the room. "That went smoothly," Griffin mused from the corner of the conference room, where he stood leaning against the wall with his arms folded. Zod rounded on him, his face like a thundercloud. Griffin ignored the glare and said briskly, "Well, don't let me hold you up, General. I'm sure you'll be wanting to get back to New Krypton." The chipper tone vanished from his voice, and his eyes were like ice as he added, "Immediately." Zod kept glaring for half a second. Then he composed himself and said coldly,
We leave first thing in the morning.
Fine, Griffin said. A pleasure, as always.
Zod nodded with stony politeness and took his leave.
Griffin frowned thoughtfully, looking off into the middle distance for a few moments, then went out the other door, down the hall, and into his office. He found Kara there, sitting in the armchair in the corner, looking upset.
You gave the general a pretty hard time, he observed mildly as he sat down at his desk.
I'm sorry, Kara said, eyes downcast. I don't like him. He gives me the creeps.
Griffin nodded. Yeah, he said. He gives me the creeps, too.
He nibbled pensively at the end of his thumbnail for a moment, then turned to her and said, Listen, you'd better get over to Titan's Tower. I have a bad feeling about this. That afternoon, someone threw a bus through the front portico of the Neo-Kryptonian Embassy. Witnesses identified the thrower as a petite blonde who fled the scene at high speed. Under the circumstances, the suspect list was short. Too short for Griffin's liking. He switched off the sound in the Avalon 17 window on his desktop, where the special report was still playing, and concentrated on the faintly glowing scarlet gem affixed to his wrist computer. Tim, he thought. Go ahead, Chief, the mental voice of Robin replied. Where's Kara? Right here. And before you ask, she's been here all afternoon. Someone's been with her the whole time. She and Cyborg were playing Puzzle Titans when it happened. Damn. I don't like this. Zod's playing it squirrely this time. I can't figure what rational motive he could have. Unless... Robin's voice was grim and certain. Unless it isn't rational. Batten down the hatches, Tim. I think it's going to be a long day. Roger that, Chief. Concluding his lens conversation, Tim Drake looked around the Titan's Tower control room for a second, gathering his thoughts. Then he went to the control panel by the door and punched a key, switching the tower's internal lighting from white to red. That got everyone's attention. Switching the PA system to all call, he announced, Titans, we've got trouble. Suit up and come to the control room ASAP. Switching off again, he added, Cyborg, take over here. Get everybody together and prep for a briefing. I have to suit up and check a couple of things. Instantly businesslike, Cyborg shut off the Z-mover and nodded. Gotcha. What should I do? Kara asked. Just stay here for now, Drake said. This concerns you. Without explaining, he hustled to the elevator and went down to his quarters. After suiting up, he sat down at his control console, logged on, and sent out an emergency page. Within 30 seconds, the Titan's current Experts of Justice liaison agent appeared in a secured chat channel. Robin. Q, I need your help. Question. You want to know why General Zod is overplaying his hand just to get hold of Kara Zor-El. Robin. How do you... Never mind. Got anything on it? Question. Plenty. I've had my eye on our friend the General for some time, but his present behavior makes no sense. Perhaps between us we can find a pattern. 5 minutes later, Zod arrived to find the International Police Building all but deserted. He was completely unchallenged as he went to the 38th floor and strode down the hall into Griffin's office. It surprised him mildly to find the IPO chief sitting calmly at his desk. He had half expected that the man would have fled with his subordinates before the oncoming wrath of Zod.
Chief Hutchins, he said, I trust you have heard a report of the terrorist attack your ward mounted on her own people's embassy today.
I've heard a report that an unknown subject who might have been Kryptonian attacked the new Krypton embassy, Griffin replied equably. I was unaware that conclusive evidence had surfaced implicating Kara. In fact, that would be of great interest to me, since I know for a fact that she was nowhere near Embassy Row at the time.
Robin. These records show some mighty irregular financial transactions at high levels in the NKDF.
question.
That's nothing. Have a look at the budgets for the Departments of Health and Education.
Robin, 37 million credits for Antarian flu immunizations?
Question, and 112 million for Vulcan spelling primers. He's manipulating every level of government to funnel secret money into his war chest.
Robin, but who's he going to war against?
Question, do you see anything that could pay for interstellar troop ships?
Robin,
oh.
I'm not inclined to play word games with you, Earthman, Zod said tightly. Kara Zor-El is now a fugitive from Neo-Kryptonian justice. As a duly designated officer of that justice, I am formally requesting that your agency help me apprehend her and deliver her to New Krypton for trial.
Griffin rose from his seat and walked slowly around to the end of his desk, his hands folded behind his back.
You're going to have to come up with better evidence than somebody saw that whoever did it was blonde, if you plan on filing for extradition, he pointed out.
Extradition? Zod blurted.
Naturally, Griffin said. Kara's not a Neo-Kryptonian citizen. If you take her from the Republic of Zeta Cygni without due process, that's international kidnapping.
Robin.
Okay, so he's plotting to launch a coup and take over New Krypton, and it looks like he has the assets to make it work. That doesn't explain why he wants Kara. Unless...
Question.
Exactly.
Robin.
Because she's an L.
Question.
Because she's an L.
Robin.
Jor-El humiliated Zod before the Science Council when Zod was still a military officer, then blocked his attempt to become military liaison to the Council itself.
Question.
He also foiled two previous attempts Zod had made to organize the assets for a coup.
Robin.
He outmaneuvered Zod for years, until Zod finally got the upper hand.
Question.
And murdered Jor-El and his wife.
Robin.
And since Kal-El disappeared in 2207...
Question.
Kara's the last of the family.
Robin.
Classic, irrelevant monomania. This guy might as well be one of Bruce's.
Question.
Our friend Kara is in grave danger.
Robin.
Our whole city is in grave danger. Can you get here? We may need you.
Question.
Unfortunately not. I'm on New Krypton.
Robin.
Question. How do you think I got access to all these military computers? They're not exactly on the internet.
Question.
I must say, for an advanced society, the Neo-Kryptonians are very lax about securing the crawl spaces under the elevated floors in their data centers.
Robin.
Right. Well, thanks for your help. I gotta go.
Question.
Good luck, Robin.
Robin signed off and dashed back up to the control room. It was time to let the others know what they were up against.
For all that he felt an intense dislike for this particular Earthman, Zod had to admit he had guts. He knew full well that Zod could destroy him a dozen different ways with the slightest of efforts, and yet there he stood, staring down the future ruler of New Krypton like a king refusing to be cowed in his own little kingdom. Such arrogance! It would be so great a pleasure to crush him.
I'm going to ask you this just one more time, Zod said, keeping his voice as even as possible. Will you surrender Kara Zor-El?
For a moment, Griffin didn't reply. To Zod's super senses, the man seemed utterly still, as though not even his blood or his thoughts were moving. Then, with a speed that was nothing short of astonishing for an unaugmented human, he belted Zod across the chops with a full power left cross. Ordinarily, Zod should have found the blow laughable, but something odd happened. On impact, it was as though Griffin's fist exploded, detonating with the force of an artillery shell. It still didn't harm Zod particularly, but it staggered him a bit, and the sheer effrontery of it left him flat-footed. Then, as the windows of his office exploded from the contained shockwave, Griffin threw himself backwards, flipping Zod an ancient hand signal with his right hand. His left trailed fragments of metal and a curling plume of smoke as his body arched up and over the windowsill and then plunged out of sight. Roaring with rage, Zod threw himself into the air. He burst out of the wreckage of Griffin's office, intending to halt perhaps half of the Earthman's fall and let him, the rest of him, continue on toward the street. A deep blue shape flickered out from a lower window, a cloak spreading out like the wings of a great dark bird, then folding around the plummeting chief. Zod lunged downward, his fingers brushing cool blue fabric, and the dark shape was gone, swallowed up by the shadow of the Interbank Tower across the street. Zod stopped in midair and scanned the vicinity with his supervision, but there was no sign of Griffin or his cloaked rescuer. Some kind of teleporter technology? No matter. "Zod to Alpha Team," he barked into his hand link. "Fan out and find the girl. Destructive search. If anyone stands with her, kill them." Gallery Island, Lake Daniels, 11 miles from New Avalon waterfront. Raven and Griffin plunged out of a dark corner and into the situation room of the IPO Emergency Command Center, tucked away at the edge of the agency's weapons testing range, to find the systems already powered up and waiting. "Nice work, Raven," Griffin said as he unlatched the smashed, spent concussion gauntlet he'd used to sock Zod and let it fall to the floor. His ears had already stopped ringing. His hand stung a little, but the knuckles were quickly healing. He flexed it a few times, satisfied himself that it would still work, and sat down in the master monitor chair. Holographic panels rezzed up all around him as a wall full of conventional monitors lit up beyond, showing him at a glance everything that was happening in the city. "Do you want to go to the tower?" he asked Raven. She shook her head. "You may need me here," she said. She didn't elaborate, but he knew what she meant. "If Zod's people figure out where we are, I'm your only chance of surviving." Though Griffin was usually secure enough in his abilities not to mind when a situation proved to be beyond them, this rankled. He hated the idea of running away to a hole in the ground and hiding while other people fought to protect his city and Kara from a bastard like Zod. But what choice did he have? He was one of the most powerful and competent martial artists in the universe, but his arts would avail him little against the phenomenal power of a Kryptonian, let alone more than one of them. If he could have activated his Asgardian battle armor, he might have had a chance, and he ached for the opportunity. But the armor, forged in the fires of the Ragnarok, would not answer the summons in Midgard, a problem even Skuld herself had never been able to fix. He growled at the back of his throat and started keying open communications channels. At the same time, he reached into his lens and touched one of the most familiar minds in the great constellation of them that made up the lens network, Lou Durgo, who was in still another secured location, this one deep in the tunnel network below the city. "Lou."
"Here, Chief."
"Call a general evacuation of the downtown area. I want Across to back up the police on that. Their weapons won't be much good against targets as small as Zod and his people."
"Roger,"
Lou replied.
"Marty's already firing up their command center. I'm coordinating other assets to assist them. Most of the agents we have in town right now would get killed if they went up against these guys directly."
Another, almost identical voice, another of Lou's three Kargite selves, chimed in, "The WDF is on standby in case things get really bad."
"I'm on hold with the Neo-Kryptonian Department of State, trying to find out if Zod's people have authorization to use lethal force," the third added.
"Armory section wants to know if we break out the kryptonite," said the second.
"Negative," Griffin replied. "Violation of the Ares Convention article on radiological weapons. If we find out they're not operating with government sanction, maybe, but that's a can of worms I'd rather not open if we don't have to.
Do we know how many of them there are yet?"
"Reports are a little sketchy,
but Imra thinks there are 5 of them, maybe 6. It looks like they're grid-searching the city and trashing anything that slows them down. I've got reports of 1 pair and the rest moving singly. Get that locked down as fast as you can. I need to know exactly what we're up against. Are any near headquarters? Only General Zod, and he's moving away. If the others are doing a grid, though, they might come by. Tell Bruce to make sure none of these bastards get into the deep labs, Griffin said. He's already mean, green, and on the scene, the first Lou assured him. Great. Speaking of green, where the hell is Alan Scott? Broadcaster's conference on Seleucia. Damn. What about the Juggernaut and Spitfire? Loan them to CID on Kotoba. Sprock. Kamio Hoshi? At L-Expo. With Tony Stark. Griffin palmed his face. The sentiment behind the gesture carried to Lou through the lens link. I think we're in trouble. She didn't respond, because, really, what could she say to that? Instead, she busied herself with her own main problem, providing solid intel for the chief's coordination efforts. The picture began to take shape, and as he expected, Griffin did not like what it showed him. With the comm systems in his consoles and the power of his lens, he started pulling together what he could to counter. 17-year-old Mary Batson stood on the balcony of her house in Claremont and watched smoke rise from the direction of Arconian Square in Salutown. As she did, her pretty, slightly mousy face took on a look of increasing determination, a look that blanked to surprise as her mobile phone rang. "Hello?" she asked. "Mary, are you all right?" came the voice of her brother Bill. "Billy?" she blinked. "I'm fine. I was just about to go and see if I could help." "It's all over the news here," Bill said. "I wish I could be with you." "Where are you?" "Still on Missouri. I won't make it back there in time to be any help, but I know you'll give it everything you've got. Remember what I taught you?" Mary nodded, her jaw set again. "Right. I'll do my best." Bill Batson's voice was calm and warm as he said, "Good luck, little sister." "Thanks," Mary said, and then Bill hung up and she put down the phone. For another moment, she stood looking off toward the smoke. Then she drew a breath and declared in a ringing voice, "Shazam!" Lightning crashed down out of a clear blue sky. Government Center, Kandor, New Krypton. The 12 members of the Science Council returned from their lunch recess to their grand chamber at the top of the Government Center spire, anticipating nothing more taxing than an afternoon spent discussing routine matters of population growth and energy production. When they entered the chamber, however, they were stunned to see that there was already someone there. Someone had penetrated the innermost sanctum of the Neo-Kryptonian government without attracting any attention from security or setting off a single alarm. The intruder was a tall man, broad-shouldered and powerful-looking, dressed in an old-fashioned Earth-style blue suit, trench coat, and fedora. The hair at his temples, all that was visible below the hat, was black. Jarringly, he seemed to have no face.
"What in... how did you get in here?"
blurted Chairman Raoul Uv. "Calmly, gentlemen," the faceless man said in a calm voice. He raised his gloved left hand and pushed down his sleeve to reveal a softly glowing blue International Police lens, which told them all in an instant's glance that he was the expert of justice known by the codename The Question.
"What do you want, lensman? This is highly irregular,"
Raoul Uv said. The Question nodded. Despite his eerily blank visage, the chairman got the distinct impression the man was watching his eyes. "I have important information to share with you," the Question said, "concerning the attack on your embassy in New Avalon earlier today." New Avalon. Diana Prince was in over her head, and she knew it. To be fair, she had known going in that this outcome was likely. Though she was powerful, very powerful indeed, she knew what kind of opponent a Kryptonian could be, and furthermore, she knew that her opponent was trained specifically to fight and defeat
other superhumans. Against such opposition, her own strength was likely to prove inadequate. She knew all that, but she went anyway, because that was her job. She did not fear defeat. She did not even particularly fear death. Such things were beneath the dignity of the Princess of Themyscira. What she feared, if a woman like Diana could be said to fear anything, was failure. She knew enough of Zod's practices to know what fate awaited the girl the Neo-Kryptonians sought if they caught her. She would be taken in chains to New Krypton, or the man Zod would pass his judgment on her. To an Amazon, even one so assimilated into the galactic culture that her sisters thought her strange, if not outright perverted, there could be no crueler fate. So when the call came, Diana answered. She intercepted one of the searching Zodists downtown, gave him the one warning required by IPO regulations, and then, when that warning was ignored, went to war. The battle demolished a block's worth of the street and scattered the wreckage of parked cars, lampposts, and other urban impedimenta everywhere, and by the time it was over, Sergeant Varul certainly knew he had been in a fight. The last time he'd taken such a beating was at the hands of Zod himself in a training bout. Still, of the two of them, the woman had come off the worse. Even now she lay sprawled in a crater her own hurtling mass had punched in the side of a Cornet Scientifer delivery van, and Varul dusted bits of broken glass and masonry from his battered uniform as he walked unhurriedly across the street to finish her off. So intent was the sergeant on this task that he failed to notice a bulky figure in a trench coat emerge from an alley behind him, or perhaps the beating he'd received had dulled his supersenses to the point where he simply had no hint of danger. For all his size, the interloper moved quite silently as he walked into the street, stopped, and raised a massive revolver, aiming it square at Varl's back. There was a metallic click as the man in the trench coat thumbed back the hammer of his weapon. This Varul did hear, but if his senses were dulled, so were his reactions. He whirled, little faster than he would have on New Krypton, and had just enough time to make out the man's silhouette and the bright green glow shining from the muzzle of his pistol before the gun went off with a sound like a cannon. The projectile smacked into Varul's broad chest and burst, splattering him with a glowing green liquid. He yelled, reeling, as the glow assaulted his senses. His head spun, his stomach churned, and he felt a leaden weakness settled into his limbs. "Kryptonite!" he sputtered. Zod had been certain that the IPO would never dare employ such a weapon, and when Zod was certain, his followers were certain. As he staggered, though, Varul realized that whatever the stuff splattered on his chest and face was, it couldn't be kryptonite. Powdered kryptonite suspended in some kind of gel or liquid was a straightforward enough weapons application of the substance, but Varul knew what kryptonite poisoning felt like, and now that the initial surprise was past, he realized this was different. For one thing, though he felt bad, it wasn't worsening. If this were real kryptonite, he would be on his knees by now. Coma and death would follow shortly. "No," said the man in the long coat. He fired three more times, but his weapon discharged no more of the green material. Instead, Varul reeled again as heavier projectiles struck his chest like blows from the Amazon's fist, each depositing a heavy burst of ionic energy into his body as it hit. Any one of those ion pulse rounds would have dropped a bull elephant, but at the barrage's end, Varul was still on his feet. Even weakened by whatever the green stuff was, he was a Neo-Kryptonian soldier in his prime. It would take more than that to put him down. He shook his head to clear it and prepared to counterattack, but the gunman was already on top of him. There was a distinctive beep hiss as he drove a MedPak's one-shot spray hypo through his pants and into the meaty part of his leg, and as he holstered his weapon and charged Varul, his body was surrounded by an eerie purple halo effect. His hair, until now neatly clipped, visibly grew as he ran. By the time he reached the Neo-Kryptonian, it reached nearly to his waist. "It's not kryptonite," Jeff Depew told Varul in a conversational tone as he drove his right fist into the Neo-Kryptonian's gut with the full force of his charge behind it. "Kryptonite is illegal," he added, smashing his left across Varul's jaw.
"This stuff won't kill you," he said, blocking an attempted counterpunch and cracking Varl in the nose with an elbow. "It's classified as a riot control weapon." Another solid punch to the head, this time a right. "Will you hurry up and pass out?" A heavy kick to the midriff that partially doubled the Neo-Kryptonian over. "I'm getting..." Varl shot out a hand, drawing on all the speed he had left, seized Depew by the neck, and then rose to his full height, holding the burly human clean off the ground. "Unk!" Depew said. "Die," Varl snarled. His eyes glowed red as he drew on the reserves of strength he still had. "Not today," Jeff replied. With the med pack pumping through his Deodan implant, his reaction speed was superhuman as well. He whipped out his left hand, and a device popped into it from up his sleeve. There was a sharp PAM of compressed air as he triggered his jump line launcher, which fired a 3-inch duranium-tipped steel piton straight into Varl's right eye. "Ah!" Varl yelled, releasing his grip on Jeff's neck and stumbling back against a lamppost. The Neo-Kryptonian clutched at his face with both hands. Jeff hit the ground and immediately rolled backward, hitting his piton gun's retractor. The cable immediately reeled back. Blood gleamed on the slightly bent tip of the piton. Varl regained his composure and lowered his hands. Blood covered the right side of his face. "I'll make you suffer for that, Earthman," he snarled. "I'm not an Earthman," Jeff replied. "I'm a Zardon, and we've been kicking the ass of idiots like you since the Padishah Empire." Varl charged. Jeff let him come, slipped his first strike, caught two more punches on his arms, evaded an attempt at a leg sweep, then capitalized on his existing advantages by bashing Varl in his wounded eye with a hard left. The Neo-Kryptonian grunted like a bull and slammed a right into Jeff's midsection. Jeff twisted, not taking the full force of the blow, and felt his ribs stop barely short of giving way. "Wish I had another pseudo-kryptonite round," he mused. "Of course, the prototypes cost about 1,000,000 credits each, so I should feel lucky I had one." Jeff dodged around a stomping kick, gave Varl a shot to the back of the knee for his trouble, then pasted him with a back fist. Varl tagged his opponent at the point of the chin, snapping his head back, then grabbed the front of his coat and hurled him across the street, where he crashed through a mailbox and skidded under the wreckage of a car destroyed in Varl's fight with Diana. "Damn," Jeff thought as he laid sprawled under the car. "He's still stronger than me, and my medpack boost won't last much longer. I need to end this now." He shifted his weight, preparing to rise, then caught a glimpse of something gleaming in the corner of his vision. Turning his head, he saw what looked like a coil of rope lying in the gutter by the curb, just on the far side of the wrecked car. It wasn't any ordinary rope, though. That much was obvious. Ordinary rope didn't glow softly and appeared to be made of spun gold filaments. "Hello, what's this?" Jeff wondered. He reached out a hand and snatched it up just as another hand clamped around his ankle and dragged him, trench coat skirt fanning out above his head, out from under the wreckage. Varl lunged down, grabbed Jeff by the front of his coat, and hauled him upright. Jeff came up swinging. Varl had to block the punch, but to do so he had to let go of Jeff's coat. Jeff dropped into a sweep. Varl evaded it, lunging to the left, just as Jeff wanted him to. The Deodan's pulse was getting weaker within him, the violet glow of overdrive beginning to fade as the implant consumed the last of the medpack's resources. Summoning all the speed he could muster, Jeff charged in on Varl's blind side, but not to throw a punch with his already weakening arms. Instead, he whipped a coil of the golden rope over the Neo-Kryptonian's head, snugged it up under his chin, and came down with all his weight behind, pulling it taut with crossed arms and the considerable dead weight of his body. Varl gagged and grabbed for the rope, but it was dug into his flesh and he couldn't get a grip on it. He twisted, trying to throw his attacker off his back or get a shot at him with heat vision from his remaining eye, but that didn't work either. Next, he tried to take to the air, thinking to take his enemy on a one-way trip to whatever passed for the stratosphere in this bizarre place. But with the pseudo-kryptonite plastered all over his chest, he couldn't muster any speed, and all lifting off the ground did was increase the pressure on his neck. All the while, Jeff hung grimly on,
pulling with arms that were rapidly taking on the consistency of lead. "This is ridiculous," Varol thought. "I am a Neo-Kryptonian under a yellow sun. I am invincible. I shouldn't be affected by this absurd tactic in the first..." Consciousness fades rapidly when the blood flow to the brain is cut off, and it was that, not asphyxiation, that was Jeff's objective. Varol sagged, allowing Jeff's feet to touch the ground, and then fell forward. Wary of a trick, Jeff rode him down, ending up kneeling on his back. He waited until he was certain he could risk it no longer, then carefully loosened the cord. The Neo-Kryptonian coughed a couple of times, then settled to the ground with a long groan and lay inert, breathing slowly. Jeff got to his feet, sweat pouring down his face, and coiled up the rope. Then he reached into a pocket, took out an isolinear tag, activated it, and tossed it down on Varol's back before tapping his comm badge. "This is Depew," he panted. "One Neo-Kryptonian for transport to Special Detention E. Partially depowered and unconscious." "Roger that," replied the voice of Lou Durgo. "Transporting now." A moment later, Varol shimmered and vanished in a shower of blue-white light. With that taken care of, he turned and walked slowly up the street toward Diana. His whole body ached. He felt like millions of tiny ants were crawling around under his skin. This wasn't like the usual Deodan comedown, but he didn't have the mental bandwidth to find that as troubling as he should have. "Agent Prince? Diana? Can you hear me?" he asked as he reached the cratered delivery truck and leaned over the fallen Amazon. Her eyelids fluttered. Then, with the suddenness of a striking rattlesnake, her right hand shot out and closed around his throat. "Here we go again," he thought, but a moment later she realized her error and let him go. "I'm sorry about that," she said, slowly picking herself up out of the smashed truck. "I thought you were..." She looked around him at a demolished street. "Where's Varol?" "Sleeping off a migraine. Are those caused by arterial dilation? I forget. Anyway," Jeff said, proffering the yellow rope. "Yours, I presume." "Thank you." Diana took it back, tried to hang it from a loop on her belt, noticed that the loop had been torn off, and coiled the rope around her slim waist instead. She was dressed differently than the last time he'd seen her. Then she was wearing stylish but ordinary clothes, a blouse, slacks, and low boots. This time she had on an odd outfit that was almost Spartan-looking, sandals with knee-high leather-taped lacings, a golden eagle-crest breastplate over a black half-singlet, a knee-length black skirt that wasn't so much a skirt as a couple of cloth panels draped fore and aft, and a yellow IPO field belt. The black parts sparkled slightly, he noticed. They had silver speckles woven into their makeup, making them resemble a night sky splashed with stars. She had on the silver bracers she'd sported at their first meeting, plus a golden metal tiara with a red star on the front. The star matched a pair of earrings she wore. She was scuffed, bruised, and abraded, but she was still a remarkably good-looking woman, and there was a certain regal air in her bearing that the gold and black armor she wore seemed to emphasize more than her street clothes had. Jeff felt a little woozy, then felt kind of silly about that, until he realized it wasn't actually from looking at her. "Are you all right?" she asked, looking concerned. He blinked. Her face snapped into focus, then swam out again. "Now that you mention it," he replied, sounding to himself as though he were speaking from a long way off, "I feel a little weird." Then he pitched forward, banging his forehead on the head of her eagle crest in a way that should have been both embarrassing and painful, but was neither, because he was quite unconscious by then. Taken aback, Diana nonetheless held him up easily while she called for medevac transport.